Our light isn't working, but I think I can read all right. We are pleased to have with us tonight Nicholas Park. First, a few little announcements. Welcome, everybody. I'm David Alkeck. I'm the president of this august body. And would like to welcome any newcomers, any first-timers. Hey, great. How did you hear from us, about us?
Skip Kilmer.
Skip?
Yeah.
All right. Skip. And how did you hear? You heard?
On the internet.
On the internet. Great. Okay. Well, this organization's been doing what it does for about 40 years. Was there another one?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Where did you hear about it?
Internet.
In the internet?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yes, I think you're the man we need to talk to, I think. you wanted to give a talk, I think. Yes, okay. So this organization's been going on for about 40-plus years, I guess. Primarily philosophers and academic philosophers at the beginning. We've kind of expanded. Not all of our speakers are philosophers. As a matter of fact, our speaker tonight is a physicist, and we've had, you know, various subjects from poetry and art, and as well as philosophy, psychology, history, all kinds of things. Make sure that you take care of your bill and you take care of your server. Don't let us get caught with, walking your bill. Philosophy isn't free. We do have our expenses, so we charge $5 to come to hear our lectures. It's only $2 for a student, for full-time students. So anyway, anything else I missed, David? Okay, so let me introduce our speaker, Nicholas Park. He was born in northwestern New Jersey and then moved to suburban northeastern New Jersey near the great New York City. Graduated from high school there. Got a bachelor's degree in physics from Swarthmore. That's on the main line, isn't it? And an MA in physics and math from Duke. He's been teaching high school physics ever since then, first in Northern Virginia, then in Carrollton, and now at the Green Hill School, from which our eminent Skip gets a lot of our speakers. He says that he converted to Orthodox Christianity. The Russian variety, we had a little talk, is that the Russian variety, instead, not the Greek or the Armenian or the Serbian or whatever. We talked about that. So during his college years, before that, mainstream Presbyterian Methodist background, has seven children, and he says his interests are my faith, my family, teaching, and science. In that order? I wonder. and when time allows, I love to walk in the woods. So without any further ado, Nicholas Park.
Good evening. Thank you for having me. So it's an honor to speak before a group of philosophers.
Can they hear you?
Can I be heard? Yes?
Not very well.
No? Is this on?
It's on.
Is this on?
It's louder.
How's that?
That's better.
That's better?
Okay.
So, philosophy, I think, is the answer to the question that I was asked when Skip asked me to give this talk. He came up to me and the question he posed was, I'm interested that you can reconcile religion and science and your appreciation for both. And I told him, well, I'll have to get back to you on that. And after a little bit of thought, I realized that they really come from the same root. I'm interested in science and I'm interested in my faith for exactly the same reason, and that is ultimately philosophy, which is defined in this root words as love of wisdom. Okay? The search for truth, the search for meaning, the search for purpose in life. I've always been a thinker, a thoughtful person. I have a picture of myself. It's somewhere in my house now, I don't know where, but I can clearly picture it to myself. Of myself as a 7-year-old boy, sitting on a little red wooden bench, next to a red wooden wall with big old windows. It was the walls of the clubhouse at the lake that I grew up on. And behind the windows, you can see all these pool tables and table tennis tables and people playing. And if you turned around and looked behind the cameraman, the person taking the picture, you would have seen all the fields, people playing outside. Here I was sitting on the bench engrossed in a book. So, was I somewhat socially awkward? Was it just a really good book? Or did I love to be alone with my thoughts and with a book? Yes, yes, and yes. All three were true. I like to think that over the years I've gotten over the social awkwardness to some extent, learned to how to relate with other members of the human species. But I've remained a thinker, and I love to think deeply about things. I also, related to that, I'm really not one for small talk, and that really bothers people sometimes because it bores me. I want to get to something that has significance and meaning. I anti-procrastinate. I get all the little tiny tasks done really fast so I can get on to the things that I really am inspired to think about and do. So there's a little bit about me, and I think that leads to the answer to the question of why I love science, and also why I love my faith in particular. So let me discuss those things in turn. First, I'll spend some time discussing science, what it is that inspires me about science, and about science teaching. And then I'll come back to the religion question, and then at the end I'll kind of bring them together. So science, my love of science began in my 11th grade in high school. And this was when I took my first physics course. And a couple of things came together for me. Well, actually, three, which is more than a couple. Three things came together for me at that time. One was I definitely had an aptitude for physics. Second, it was my first exposure to a challenging, caring, inspiring, and inspired teacher in science. And that makes such a difference in someone's life. Okay. And the third thing was the subject itself I found incredibly fascinating and inspiring, because it started to answer some of those deeper questions, or at least ask and give the ability to probe, if not answer, some of those deeper questions. What is gravity, actually? What is stuff made of? What are the forces that hold things together? And how is it that those forces actually explain all the complex things at different levels we see happening in the world? Where did the universe come from? How did we get here? Right? All those questions, physics started to try to answer, and that was fascinating to me. And so I really got into it. And to this day, that's what fascinates me about the subject of physics. I'll tell you the most recent examples of that. I'm currently teaching two elective courses for the first time, sort of. I've actually taught these topics before, but over a decade ago. That doesn't count. So I was redefining these courses over the course of the fall and to get ready for them. One of them is a biophysics course. And so I'm looking at this, and there's so many directions you can go with the biophysics course. So I was reading multiple textbooks and books over the course of the fall, and I think my family, my wife and my children and my parents were kind of laughing at me internally, because here I was on my parents' couch over Christmas break reading a biophysics textbook. And every few pages I would say this marvelous thing I just discovered about how the fundamental laws of thermodynamics explain the biochemistry of the cell and how that's really cool. And my sister would say, well, I'm glad you find it cool. So this led into this course, and I'm having lots of fun with the course, and the kids are loving it too, and I'm using almost none of what I read, but that's okay. The other course I'm doing is an astrophysics course. And I taught an astronomy course before, but the time that I taught that course was the same time that some of the stuff we're studying now was being discovered. So much has changed. We're actually using a online course taught by some professors at university in Australia, and basically I'm acting as their coach to guide them through understanding the physics behind what is being said by those professors and giving them experiences. And it's amazing just to look at how just by looking up at the sky and measuring the intensity and spectrum of the light that we get, we can determine all this stuff. And so that amazing ability to discover something about the truth of stuff in these simple ways, and to see how students latch onto that and love it too, reminds me not only of why I love science, but why I went into teaching the first time to begin with. To see that spark of, wow, this is cool. Which I don't always get with, you know, introductory, you know, moving at constant speeds on the floor. Okay, so that's the basic facts of science itself and why I love it. There's another side to it, though. And that is not so much the scientific end result, the things we learn, as the process itself. And that process, especially as a science educator, is really, really important. And I have to give some background for this. And this has to do with the nature of human knowledge acquisition and understanding and stuff. I take my students every fall through an exercise of observing some simple scenario. And the goal of that whole process is to realize that we can write down our observations and then compare them. And we all observe different things when watching the same phenomenon. Just because we were paying attention to different things, or because we filtered out different things as unimportant, we focused on different things, and so there's a subjectivity just in the observation process. Okay, take it a step further, the data analysis process. We analyze it differently. We choose different findings there. We have a subjectivity there. We have a subjectivity in our use of reason to try to make models and describe things. I think people who have really looked into this are aware that, do you know what the way humans are, the thing we do best with our reason, what we most often use our reason for and most effectively use our reason for, is to convince other people of the thing we already believe to begin with. Or to convince ourselves of the thing we already believe to begin with. So we take what we want to believe, what we think we know, and we cherry-pick and find evidence to support it, ignoring all that inconvenient other stuff, either consciously or subconsciously, and make an argument, right? That's debate. Now, if you look at our schooling, so much of what our kids do in school in many classes is just learning to do that, but do it better. And where science comes in is it tries to break that mold. Through the process of peer review and consensus, and having to discuss your observations together with others, and your models together with others, and the patterns you have and the reasoning, and having them critique it, we start to come towards some measure of objectivity. And that's a beautiful thing, because the subjectivity divides people. Bringing together and comparing and having a conversation where you can listen to someone else's perspective brings people back together, which is very, very, very much needed in our divided culture today. So, that's another reason why science, I think, is so central, and science education for students in particular. Okay. So we have a... that being said, the process isn't perfect. And that's because of that subjectivity of the humans involved. So let's look a little at the philosophy of science. You might be familiar with Karl Popper. So Karl Popper basically said science is this process of coming up with theories and then attempting to falsify them. So everything you do is trying to falsify the theory so that any theories that have issues with them go away. Okay? Well, then along comes later another philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn. And he said, well, yeah, Karl Popper's idea is great. It's the ideal. But it doesn't actually happen a lot of the time. Because people get really, really wedded to their theories. People, again, we like our ideas. We like to look for reasons to support our own ideas. We don't really like to look for evidence against our own ideas. That's really not something that we find enjoyable. And so what happens is, Kuhn did this analysis of various different, what he called scientific revolutions, and noted that a huge paradigm shift, as he called it, a huge change in scientific thought, generally only happened generationally. You had to wait for the old guys to die. And the new guys who held the new idea to become in the majority for a huge change in scientific thought to occur. Well, that's not ideal, right? That's holding up scientific progress. I read an article in Physics Today just yesterday And this article was talking about how multiple different instances of where progress in science would have happened much more rapidly if people had been willing to listen to the guy who was questioning the status quo, instead of saying, just kind of pushing him out of the way. So that's one thing. There's other ways in which the process can work not as intended as well. And that is, what if everybody in the investigation group and the peer review group holds the same bias and the same presuppositions? Is that process going to work to eliminate that bias? No. Okay. What if there is some sort of material or financial incentive that is getting in the way of people being honest in their research? I watched a great, anyone familiar with Veritasium? It's a YouTube channel that this guy, Derek Mueller, who does physics instructional videos and other things out there, lots of very interesting things. He does a great job, does extensive research into stuff, but he did a video I watched the other day on the effect of the publication process on science. And the idea that because publication is a market-driven business, there is a large financial incentive for researchers to produce results that are going to be interesting to the readership of the journals. So null results are generally not interesting and are often rejected. He gave an example of, I unfortunately forget the actual result, but it was a really surprising result. It just didn't make a whole lot of sense. But they found that this result happened with, you know, slightly over the required confidence interval. Okay? And this was published and was really cool. Well, someone looked at this and said, well, statistical fluctuations could cause that to happen just by random chance. So let's do a repeat study. That's how science works, right? Do it again. Let's check. They did their repeat study, found no effect. But the journal rejected the article because it wasn't interesting. So that's science failing to operate. So science is a wonderful process of trying to come to some objectivity, and because it's a human process, it has its failings as well. And I should have a timekeeper of some sort here.
You got a half hour.
Okay. So that brings me to religion. Okay. So appreciation for religion. And I have to start by saying that I'm going to actually draw a distinction between religion and faith. That they're different things. Okay? And so do I appreciate religion? Yes and no, depending how you define religion. Do I appreciate every manifestation in the world today that calls itself religion? No. Okay? Because a lot of things are done in the name of religion that are really just manifestations of human anger and greed and lust for power and things like that going on in the world. And just religion's used as a cover for it, as a context for it. So, now if by religion, however, I mean this idea of man's search and striving to come into contact and connection with something higher than ourselves, well, I appreciate that. That's a very laudable process of looking for something greater and trying to connect with it. Okay? And there are various manifestations of that in the world. I would say, however, and now I'm going to make a very, very orthodox Christian claim, that that process is, in some sense, ultimately doomed to failure. Doomed to failure, yes. And the reason is because I believe in a very specific God that exists, and that our trying to connect with him isn't going to work unless he also simultaneously comes down to connect with us. And so religion by itself without revelation doesn't work. You have to have the connection go both ways. I'll come back to that, okay, in a little bit. Okay, so let me describe my journey to faith, because that kind of lays the background, how I got there in terms of evidence and reasoning and stuff, and then I'll start to go a little deeper. So this also happened in 11th grade. Kind of a transformative time. I guess it's when you start thinking. And it happened, as opposed to in physics class, this happened in history class, when we were studying this guy called John Calvin. And I happened to be attending a Presbyterian church at the time. And if you know anything about that, the Presbyterian church is descended from Calvinism, kind of historically. So I read about this, and so I was given this picture, and from my perspective, this idea of Calvinism didn't really fit. It didn't sound good. So here I have this picture of a God who has created, to grossly oversimplify, two kinds of people. the kind that are the chosen ones, who would go into life and basically, you know, get his blessings now and then and stuff, and eventually die and go live with him in heaven in eternal bliss forever. And then the other kind of people that he created, that would go down to earth and not really get very many blessings, and then when they die, they'd go into eternal torment forever. Not because of anything they did, or wanted to do, or could do, but just because he made it that way. And I was supposed to believe that, and I went to the minister at my church and asked, and she said, "Oh, you can just believe what you want, it's okay." to which I said, "Then why are we here?" Okay. So that idea, I mean, my thought on that kind of picture is, you know, if you are a thinker and are searching for meaning and a philosopher, and you are exposed to that kind of God and only that kind of God, and you reject God and become an atheist because that's a hideous thing, I think God will reward you for that. So I went from there, that kind of faded into the background because I was a teenager and just doing what I was doing. But then I went away to college, and in college years we also have these little things we go through. We're not in our parents' house anymore. I'm speaking too fast. Slow down. And I started to explore a bunch of different things, and I went to different places and different religions. I'm not going to bore you with all the details. But I ended up, after several years, converting to Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And what I'm going to describe is the main aspects of the reasoning for that at that time. And then I'm going to come back with what I think are arguments that I think are more important to me now. Okay? The reasoning at that time was I was searching for something true, which Calvinism did not seem to be true. Okay? I was searching for something ultimately true. And I was only looking at Christianity. I didn't really consider at the time anything else. And so I was exploring these ideas, and I was exploring the idea that if Jesus Christ is the Son of God and came to earth to restore us, and he gave us these teachings and he gave us this church, and these are all important, then this is God himself, then those teachings should endure. And that discipline and that body of people the teachings and the practice should endure, and you should see them in historical continuity, everywhere throughout the world and throughout time. They should be the same. Because if they really came from God himself, it wouldn't be that he made it one way and then people changed it to something else. And so I'm looking at the history of different Christian churches, and I'm saying, okay, all these, the Presbyterian church, other Protestant churches, well, they just came into being 3 or 4 centuries ago. So I can't trace that back. I look at the Roman Catholic Church, and it's been around for all that time, but if you look at the specific teachings, they've made huge changes at various points in history that you can quantify. You can look at this as a big change in teaching, big change in practice. I looked at the Eastern Orthodox Church when I finally found it, and it really didn't look the same. The teachings that it taught, you can read stuff, documents from the 2nd century, from the 4th century, from the 6th century, from the 10th century, from the 14th, from the 21st, and the essential teaching is the same. It's wrapped in different words, sometimes for different languages, but for different audiences, different times, different things opposing it. But the essential teaching is the same. The essential practice is the same. You know, the nature of the worship, the nature of the sacraments, they're all there, they're the same, but maybe sometimes wrapped in different forms and different cultural surroundings. And that was, wow, right? That makes, there's something, if Christianity is true, this is true Christianity, was my conclusion. Okay. And so I kind of got into that. As I kind of further developed, I also investigated a little bit of the truth claims of Christianity itself, and was fairly convinced that you can look at the historical nature of the reality. You can actually find evidence of the life of Jesus Christ living on the earth, dying on the cross. And you can even investigate the claim of the resurrection, and this is a pretty compelling case can be made. There's a book called The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, and he talks about like analyzing the psychology of the apostles and the forensic evidence, things like that, arguing that the best explanation for the historical evidence available is that he really did rise from the dead, you know, given the alternatives. But anyway, that's more of an aside. There's a deeper level to this. So I came into the Orthodox Christian Church because of this idea of this consistency, this consistent truth claim. I love being in it, and it is inspired by it daily, and it informs my life because of something deeper than that. which is a deeper claim to truth and meaning. And in order to really help you understand that, I have to give you a quick theology lesson and a quick anthropology lesson from an Orthodox Christian perspective. Are you ready? Okay. So first, the theology lesson. First, I'm going to do a contrast. Because often when people think of Christian theology, they think of a different theology than the one the Orthodox Christian Church holds. And if I don't mention what that is, then the assumption will be that that's in there somewhere and I didn't say it. So I'm going to briefly describe the theology of Anselm of Canterbury, which became very popular in the West. And then I'm going to contrast that with the one that we hold. Okay? So the theology of Anselm of Canterbury, which 10th century, I think, was the basic idea that, okay, so there's God, and he makes man. Man's in the Garden of Eden. Man says, no, we're not going to obey you, God. God is offended. Okay? And there's two ways to describe that. Either he's personally offended, okay? And because he's God and is therefore infinite, he's infinitely offended, and therefore a finite man can never make up with him. And so there's this, his offense is this, getting this wall between God and man, right? The other description is that it's not so much him personally as like divine justice that's offended, this force that he's subject to and can't go against. But that's infinite too, right? So man can't heal that. And so God has to send his son becomes a man, his son is tortured in miserable ways, and that somehow satisfies the infinite, either God's infinite offense or this infinite justice. And so everything can be fixed. Okay, so I look at that, and I say, okay, that gives me one of two pictures of God. One, either he's like a five-year-old in a temper tantrum, okay, which I don't really like, or he's subject to some other power higher than himself, in which case he's not really God. Okay, so from that argument, I'm going to go back to, well, you know, I could say that if you're going to reject that God, that might be a good thing. Okay? So, in contrast, here is the Orthodox Christian understanding of that process of what happened. So God is not just good, he's goodness itself. He's not just life. He's not just a source, he's not just living, he's life itself. He's not just powerful, he's power itself. And I can go on, right? You get the idea. And he created the world and gave the world all these gifts purely out of love so that others besides himself would have the joy of living. And he created the world and gave different creatures different gifts. So some just the gift of existence. Then there is the vegetative life. It gets this gift of growing and reproducing and all that, right? Then you have those gifted with animal life, which is that plus the ability to move, the ability to think and reason to varying degrees depending on the species, right? So all that just in animal life. And then this highest gift of all given to mankind, which is this inner knowledge, what is known in our theology as the noetic faculty from the Greek word for knowledge. Okay? This inner knowledge where we can directly know God himself through a direct connection to him. And through that same faculty, we are given, we call it in the Bible, his image and likeness. Some of his capacities, free will, conscience. And I think the chief of these, the ability to selflessly love, true altruistic love. Many would deny that that's possible, right? There's a lot of writing about how things that look like altruistic love, it's really you're just trying to make yourself feel good, right? And probably in most cases it is because we're fallen, okay? But this gift that God gave to man is the ability to be like him, to love truly selflessly when there's nothing in it for you even feeling good. And so that's kind of the initial status, this gift that he gave to us. But then, here's the rub. He's the goodness. He's the life. He's the light. He's the joy. And so here we are. We have these gifts, and we have them in connection with him. It's like there's a string, like an electrical cable tying us to him, but we get the juice through. Okay? And then we came along, and we said, well, yeah, this is great, but I want to do it myself. I want to be separate from him and be my own power, my own life, my own love. And so we cut the cable. And cutting the cable, what have we just cut ourselves off from? The source of all those things that make us who we are. So we lose power. We lose power over ourselves, and hence this internal jumble that is a human being nowadays, right? We have these conflicting internal tendencies, the desire to eat, the desire to procreate, the desire to have power in order to act in the world. All those things were good things built into us for a purpose, and they become competing because there's nothing directing them. There's no hierarchical structure in us directing them all toward a good aim. And so there's a battle in us, a battle of emotions, a battle of desires, a battle of thoughts, and we're a mess inside. We've lost the power over ourselves. We can't compel ourselves to do what we know we want to do. So we've lost the connection to love. And so for the most part, we don't. We aren't able to love altruistically, right? I could go on, but you get the idea. So there's this connection that's broken. So now, imagine that electrical board again that was connected between us and God. We cut it. Now we have our loose end. We can't retie it because we can't reach the other end. And so that's why God himself becomes a man, comes down to the earth. He brings the other end with him. Now he's man, he's God, he has both ends, he can tie them back together in his own person, and then to the extent of which we're connected to him, we then can be connected and reconnected with God and have those powers back. Okay. So that's the basic theological argument that we make. And so why am I saying that's so inspiring? Because it's a fix to that crazy condition that we call humanity, right? So not only do we see something true in our minds, but we have connection to something that is healing for us. So we can, like philosophy in its real true sense, like Socrates was not just aiming to know stuff, but also to be something. And that's what this gives us, the ability not just to know things, but also to become something that we know is greater and better and gives us joy and peace. Okay, I'll transition then to the anthropology lesson. Okay, and I briefly mentioned it already, that there are many ways that the fathers of the Orthodox Church discussed how to describe the construct of the human person. Most of them were essentially borrowed from Platonic philosophy and kind of embellished a little bit based on their own experience. One of those ways was the one I described already, this idea we have, we share the vegetative nature and the animal nature, and then this higher, this noetic knowledge of God in us. The reason I bring that up again is because what that gives us is another source and method of knowledge. So we have knowledge through the senses and through reason. We also have knowledge through direct apprehension of God, this noetic knowledge. And they're both there. And so we have another way to know things that acts on top of that. We see how we're coming to have these two different approaches to knowledge here. The trouble with this noetic knowledge, however, is that we've clouded it. So I talked about this competing maelstrom of emotions and thoughts and desires that is our heart and our... And so if that noetic knowledge is like a little porthole through which we can communicate with God, and there's a sandstorm in front of it, can we use it? And the answer is no, right? We're too cloudy inside. And so we don't even really know the porthole's there. And so that's why the church has this ascetic tradition of just trying to deny these passions, these things that distract us. Not because they're bad, they were created good, but because they're in a jangled mess. And so we're trying to kind of clean ourselves up. And so one of the dangers of religious knowledge in this sense, or knowledge through this faith, is we are really good, as I've said before, deceiving ourselves. And so someone who first starts to explore these ideas and gets involved in this, you know, they, oh wow, noetic knowledge, I can directly apprehend God, that's cool. And the first thing they tend to do is, well, they'll have an experience that's a purely physical manifestation of the assurance of truth that comes through just repeated contact with an idea. That's a psychological thing. It happens, right? You're sure something is true just because it's familiar to you. And you confuse that with noetic knowledge, which you don't have yet. Okay? So there's a danger of deluding ourselves there that is a big deal. So, why do I think all that's true? Why do I have a sense that, you know, I have an evidence for this, that this is all real and I'm not just making it all up? A number of the things I've said touch on that, but one more thing I can say, two more things I can say, One is that I know of people, acquaintances, you know, fairly direct connections, who are farther along that path of coming to know God in these ways, and you can see the fruits in their lives. You can see, if you look at the saints of the church, why do we call them the saints of the church? Because they're examples, and we can see, wow, it looks like they really do have what is some form of selfless love. They really do have a joy and a peace and a humility, which is the hardest thing of all, that I just can't understand. It's really there. Okay? And so that is evidence that there really is this thing that can happen, okay? Which is, I think, the best news in the world. There actually are miracles that occur to this day, very rarely, because people, honestly, are not convinced by miracles. Okay? We, like I said, we look for evidence for what we want to believe, not for what we see around us. Okay? And finally, and I think this is the most compelling reason, is we can look at the world and there's this wonderful and also tragic duality in the world. You look in the world and there's all kinds of tragic stuff that goes on. There's also amazing beauty. You look at yourself and there's a mess inside, but there's also this very clear understanding of it shouldn't be like that. You can recognize what's wrong and think of, conceive of something higher. And I think the whole idea that we're created in this state of connection to God and goodness, and we broke that, explains all that really well, those two things. So, that is what I would say, my arguments for why I appreciate and love my faith. It has its flaws, just like science does. Okay? Where are those flaws? Again, it's in the human element. Because there's a human organization of people in a church, which means there's people in positions of power, many of whom like to have positions of power. And passions and power and love of wealth and those things start influencing people's behavior, and these people aren't acquiring no knowledge of God, they're acquiring power, right? And that is manifest in the world and is manifest in what people are teaching. And I think that brings me then to one of the subject of the conflict between religion and science that many people see. They'll say, how can you believe in religion and appreciate science? Aren't they contradictory? And I would say no. And here's the reason. Because both have these ability, both have this flaw that humanness and human stuff can get in the way and lead to inappropriate conclusions and overreaching on the part of both. And I would posit, and I have not yet proved myself wrong, okay? I would posit that all the seeming conflict comes past that point when they're overreaching. Does that make sense? I would give a couple examples, okay? The first example I'm going to give is the one that everyone mentions first, and that is Copernicus. So we think of Copernicus and how, you know, he was following what the science was telling him, and he was being persecuted by the Catholic Church for this, right? That's the way we learn it. And here's how I would explain what was happening there. Okay? And the historical development, as I understand it, was rooted in the person of the people in power in that church, and also in the monarchy surrounding it, and also the development of theology in the Catholic Church in the early second millennium. So there was this development, whereas the theological approach in the Orthodox Church, which was shared by the whole Christian Church through much of the first millennium, was this idea of we know things either through senses and reason or through direct noetic revelation, as I mentioned. Now, many of us, our minds are too clouded to perceive that direct noetic revelation, but we can recognize by the fruits in their lives those who do. And we can learn from them and understand what they say and try to take it to heart, right? That's the saints. That's the teachers of the church. But we don't just try to speculate about things. We learn things that are important for that goal, which is reconnection with God, and that's it. So dogma, establishing dogmas in church saying, you must believe this, was very, very rare. It's when someone came up with another theory, usually because they were trying to understand things all the way fully in their own mind, when they weren't at a point of being able to do that yet, and then latching onto the idea they generated and saying, this must be true, I'm going to really push this. That they became what the church called heretics. That just means someone who chose what they want to think. Okay? That could be any of us probably, right? But then when that happened, and when it was a big deal, most of these things aren't a big deal, right? And we just, yeah, sure, believe what you want, right? But if it's something that affects the way people live their lives and how they sought to actualize that connection with God, well, what, that's going to hurt people. So then people who knew better would have to come up against that and make these dogmas saying, no, you can't think that way because it's harmful to your connection with God and will hurt you. And so there really weren't that many instances of that. Okay. Now, what happened in the scholastic period in the West was this idea of the desire to make a systematic theology, to make it all rationally laid out clearly. And some of that was based on Aristotelian philosophy. Okay. And so these things became all connected in a big system. Okay, fine. But marry that with, at the same time, a process that had been going on since about 600 or so of various people within the Catholic Church being really, really liking that power thing, right? And having popes who became princes and power corrupts, right? And not all of them, okay, but some of them. And now you have a situation where if someone is questioning some aspect of the science that had become connected with the theology, then that's perceived as a threat to those people in power. And that's what they're up against. It's not a church science thing. It's a person in power who doesn't like what you're saying science thing. What else do I have here? Should I give you the really hard one? Okay. So I came up with this one. I said, I'm not sure you're going to totally follow me on this. You might not even buy what I say. But this is probably an example of one of the more difficult things to explain where there's a seeming contradiction. So I'm going to read a quote to you all the way. And this is from St. Basil the Great. He's a 4th century teacher in Turkey. Okay? And he wrote a book called the Hexaemeron. That means the 6 days, literally. He was commenting on the creation of the world. And this, he's commenting on the very first line of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I'll read it. If you know science, you're going to start to get uncomfortable as we go through it. And I was too. And I'll explain how I understand this when I'm done. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. I stop, struck with admiration at this thought. What shall I first say? Where shall I begin my story? Shall I show forth the vanity of the Gentiles? Shall I exalt the truth of our faith? The philosophers of Greece have made much ado to explain nature, and not one of their systems has remained firm and unshaken, each being overturned by its successor. It is vain to refute them. They are sufficient in themselves to destroy one another. Those who were too ignorant to rise to a knowledge of a God could not allow that an intelligent cause presided at the birth of the universe, a primary error that involved them in sad consequences. Ready for this? Some had recourse to material principles and attributed the origin of the universe to the elements of the world. Others imagined that atoms and indivisible bodies, molecules and ducts, formed by their union the nature of the visible world. Atoms, reuniting or separating, produce births and deaths, and the most durable bodies only owe their consistency to the strength of their mutual adhesion, a true spider's web woven by these writers who give to heaven, to earth, and to sea so weak an origin and so little consistency. So there he is, great teacher of my church, basically saying that atomic theory is bunk. And that, I mean, what he's describing is the way it is, right? That's the heart of every modern science. So, what do I think of that? Is there a contradiction there? I'm still going to say no. And the reason is I'm going to have to look at his audience, his what he knew, what the context was, and what his goals were. So, modern science as such obviously had not progressed to the point that it is now in the 4th century AD. Okay, so he was arguing against philosophers, not so much as scientists. Was there clear evidence for atomic theory at that point? Not at all. Okay? What there was, as he describes, people arguing among themselves. And if you think to who was closest to his time, the predominant philosopher of atomic theory, who really described things just in exactly the words he was using almost, the answer is Lucretius in 2nd century Rome. So, and Lucretius wrote this beautiful poetry describing how atoms fit together and come apart and how it describes all these things. But what was Lucretius' aim if you read his poetry? He wasn't aiming to establish a scientific theory. He was aiming to give support to atheism. That was his stated goal. Now, with atheism, not against Christianity, but against, you know, Roman paganism. But same thing, right? The idea that, okay, because Adam's therefore no God. Now, a man from the church who's concerned about people connecting again to God is going to come strong against that. And with no reason not to oppose it scientifically, that's his basic aim, is let's try to get at the guy who's trying to sever us from our connection with God. So now, if St. Basil was here today, do I think he would criticize atomic theory? No. Okay. It's the context. So hopefully that makes some sense. Two more time. Okay. I'll address the last issue that often comes up for a teacher of science, and that is the question of evolution and such things. Okay, so how do I handle that issue? And again, I think it's a non-issue. I think there really isn't a conflict. And I could go kind of at length, and I wrestled with this for many years trying to understand this. But I've come to a number of different perspectives on this. One is recognizing the limitations of both the scientific process and the process of interpreting, of people interpreting what the church's revelation says. Both have ways where they can go astray. And can those things have happened? I'll take the scientific side first, okay? Of all the possible flaws of science, how many could be active there? Do all of the people, most of the people in mainstream science, have more or less the same perspective when it comes to evolution? Has it become, basically, an unquestionable thing? Yes, right? And so, am I saying it's wrong? I'm not, okay? I'm saying that is a place where science can go astray when something requires that level of... certainty, yes. So there's that side of that. Check my notes a minute, sorry. Likewise, there are scientists who actually will states directly that they're building into the theory the assumption that there isn't a God, saying this is the best theory because it doesn't imply a God. Well, okay, if they want to think that way, fine, but you have to be aware then, if you're building a no God into your theory, if it ends up contradicting God, you shouldn't be surprised. Okay. Okay, great. Now, am I making a claim about what I think about evolution? No. And the reason is because I'm not a biologist. And I'm really big on, I'm not going to make a claim unless I actually have the information to support it. Okay, so I can't analyze it. I don't have the time to spend 6 years getting the education that I would need to really analyze that. So I have to trust the people who do. So then the question comes down to, who can I trust? And I don't know exactly where I can trust people or I can't, because there are people that are committed to a certain viewpoint. On those writings of evolutionary age, man, it's crazy. There is nobody who writes about it doesn't have a bone to pick. So I just say, you know, I don't know what's going on. Okay. What I do know, and this is what I teach in the classroom, is I know how science works, and I know what the accepted consensus is. And so what I teach my students is how it works and what the accepted consensus is. Okay. Because that's what we're there to learn. Let me look from the other side, though, because I think this completes the picture. Looking from the side of theology, what's the genre of the opening books of Genesis? It's a poetic description of where the world came from. You can see, like, poetic Hebrew parallels in it. Is it meant to be a literal description of what happened next and exactly what time it happened? I would question that, right? I would definitely question that. If you look at the way the church has interpreted throughout the ages, they did couch it in a literal reading of it, but the goal was never to espouse that. The goal was always to espouse God created everything, he's great, it's wonderful, and there's examples of how we should behave it. That's really what it was all about. That's the only point they made. St. Basil, I mentioned before, he went on for 9 big, long homilies, and all he said over and over again was, gee, that's amazing. And, oh, there's an example of things humans should do and things humans should not do. Over and over again. That was his point. Okay, so is Genesis meant to be a textbook? No. So I'm ultimately, what I come at is I'm not bothered by apparent contradictions. I don't think they're attempting to describe the same thing. There are flaws in everything. I don't really know it because I can't research it. And here is where I've ultimately come down to my description of how I understand it. You ready for this? Genesis is a God's eye view from outside of time, looking down into time, of how he made the world before the fall occurred. Science gives us a man's eye view, looking backward in time from within time, of how things have come to be after the fall occurred. So we're looking from different perspectives, different directions in time, different places, from different sides of this cataclysmic world event. Why should we even think they'll look the same? So my answer to the big controversy that bothers people is, it doesn't bother me because I really don't know. And I don't really think I should be able to reconcile it that much. So, to pull it back together, one of the core elements of my faith is the importance of humility, of recognizing what you don't know and being okay with that. And I think that's part of doing science, too, is that let's try to learn more, and let's be open to what other people have to say and their ideas, and let's try to come to understanding and consensus using the gifts of reason and everything else that we've been given. And love and appreciate and share this beautiful world that we live in. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions.
All right. Questions? Yes. You referred a couple times to man's fall and to rejection of God, and you also used a really impressive analogy of the power cord between man and God, and it seems to relate back to the conclusion that there was at one time, there was at some point not a separation between man and God, and later, at some point in time, there was. Are you saying that there was an actual event at some point in time where man became separated, or is that more a metaphor for something about our nature?
I understand it to be an event.
Do you base that on the story of the Garden of Eden, sort of from the Bible, or some other
source? Yes, it's that story and also how the church has understood and interpreted that story.
Question? Stephen Jay Gould, people are familiar with, the scientist, philosopher, said that there are basically two magisteria, two universes, more or less, science and religion, and they are really of separate things that they're concerned with. Science has to do with facts and figures and what we see and experience and how things are. Religion has to do with morals, good and bad, ethics, value, how we should live our life. So the two should not conflict at all. But inevitably they do conflict. And they conflict, like you say, in different aspects. So what do you feel about that? Is there a separation, or is it an inevitable conflict?
Well, I would say, first of all, I don't really buy the whole separation to magisteria thing, just because, morality, I think, is ontological. And I don't think you can separate those two things, because you're moral because of some truth that exists, because you do what is right because the result of it is ultimately good for you and for others, right? So there's an ontological component to morality. And so to separate ontology from morality, it's putting a divide where there can't be one. Does that make sense? And so where I would say The reason that I think they don't come into conflict is because I think that we have two reliable methods for finding out about truth and about what is. And if they're reliable, they're not going to be in conflict. When they overlap, they'll say the same thing. And there are many instances in which they do. There are many places in which you look at the teachings that the church has promulgated, and you look at some of the findings of modern psychology, and it's like they overlap perfectly. Because if they're describing the same reality, where they come into conflict is where we get in the way. We mess it up.
Or phrase it, right? It's always puzzled me that if God was trying to reconnect with what you're talking about, that he picked the place to do it that he did. Because most of the world had no contact with that place. And I'm wondering if that means there's a possibility that this happened more than one time or at more than one place. And I guess the one that would pop out immediately to me is the Buddha, who his message was very similar, I think, to what you're talking about. And I'm wondering, you know, might there have been shamans in the Western Hemisphere? You know, other things that happen. I know that doesn't have much to do with your religion, but it would seem to make more sense if this was something that's a little bit more global than kind of a backwater Middle Eastern culture.
So I'll give you the answer from my perspective, from our perspective, is that God becoming incarnate as a man is kind of a one-shot deal because he stays a man forever. So, I mean, Jesus Christ is up there in heaven with a human body right now. And so this is it's a one event that happened, but it affects all of humanity. It reconnects all of us. So we believe that when he was crucified, he went down at that point into Hades, where all the people were kind of waiting dead. And he communicated then to everyone who was willing to listen, just as he did on Earth. And then through the apostles sent throughout the world and the church, he communicates with everyone now. And to the extent to which we come to know him here on this Earth, we can respond. And to the extent to which we come to know him after we die, we can respond. And all the other, there were many other teachers throughout the world who had a partial message, of course. People have connections and God inspires people, right? But none of those other teachers were, in fact, God incarnate.
This is, I think, a logical follow-on from that one. I would be interested in what you think about the possibility of, let's say, intelligent life on, you know, planets and other galaxies and, you know, other parts of the universe, or maybe even go beyond intelligence and say they have the equivalent of a human soul. And if so, is it possible, is it inevitably a fall in those other contexts? And if, is it possible there's no fall? And if there is a fall, is there a necessity of another kind of revelation that's also unique in their historical context of salvation?
I think that's a really interesting question to discuss. And the only answer I can give is I don't know.
So one of the questions I always have with regards to religion and science is you know, the stability of it. We look at the teachings of religion, they've changed over the years. We look at the teachings of science, they've changed over the years. So do you believe that scientific principles are fixed in duration and have been the same throughout all time? And the same question about religion. Especially, you know, you talked about the longevity of the Russian Orthodox Church, how it's been very stable for the last 2,000 years. But of course, you know that 2,000 years ago, there's a pretty substantial change that occurred. And, you know, 1,000 years before that, would you say that religious teachings were the same, just misunderstood like science, or would you say they're fundamentally different?
So I would say that, okay, so science is obviously, it's a human process of acquiring knowledge, right? And so as we learn more and as we go through this process, it changes, ideally, to come closer and closer to some measure of what we think is a reality out there. Right? So that is obviously a changing process. Religion, well, it depends, right? Because religion as a human construct is something that humans create, and therefore it's going to be different. It's going to have different manifestations. Religion in terms of revelation by God, which has happened at various places in various times, there's going to be, God reveals himself to people as we're able to accept it, right? I mean, we're cut off from God, not because he wants that, but because we cut off. And so it's like when you're teaching a young child how to do something, you give them just the information they're ready to accept. And so there's progressive revelation of things. But then our understanding in Christianity is that this progressive revelation occurred in various cultures throughout the world for various times, but that there was one unique, complete revelation. And, you know, the Jews are called the chosen people, according to Christian theology. Why? They're chosen because they were chosen to be the people that Jesus Christ came from. That's how we understand it. And there's this process of refining and stuff, right? And so this is a complete revelation because it's not just God speaking to people, it's God becoming a person. And that's, I say that again, that's, I mean, you can't just say that, right? You can't wrap your mind around that. That's crazy. It's like, why would he do that? Why would you have to? Is that even possible? Right? So it's this full thing. And then what he teaches then becomes a unique revelation that then you have to preserve, right? It has to endure because that's coming from the horse's mouth, to use probably an analogy that isn't appropriate. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Okay, have you looked at how many famous scientists throughout history have been Christians and how their faith informed their science? I mean, I don't see the dichotomy between science and religion. For instance, Isaac Newton, who wrote Principia to the Glory of God, Blaise Pascal, Michael Faraday, there are numerous others who were devout Christians. So obviously they didn't see a conflict between science or religion. Have you looked at that?
I have not done a thorough study of it, but I definitely am aware that many great scientists were religious, yes, and Christians particularly.
What do you think of some of the positive and negative, positives and negatives from the Science March on DC work?
I have to admit that the last 3 weeks I've been really busy and out of touch, so I don't know.
You mentioned in your speech about religion and faith being different things, and you explore the religion part of it, but not the faith. Would you like to say more about that?
So faith, so I mentioned how, you know, religion versus revelation, versus, you know, God's revelation is growing out of Noetic knowledge, right? Faith, I understand faith. I actually go back to the Greek word pistis, which is translated faith, which basically has a related set of meanings. It can be translated roughly in English as faith, trust, and faithfulness. And so faith is a process of saying, okay, I know who Jesus Christ is, I know what he has said, and on that basis, I trust that what he has to say to me, being like all-knowing and all-good and loving and stuff like that, is something that's worthy of trust and worthy of following. And so that faith then starts to embrace my life. A life that is consistent with faith in him as someone reliable, as like a father, right? So it's a process of accepting and trust in the revelation that he brings, as opposed to religion being this striving of myself up toward him. Did that answer the question?
The science might or might not get to ultimate truth, but it does at least seem generally to be useful, even if it doesn't get to the ultimate truth. And there are a lot of disputes among scientists, but most well-respected scientists, generally speaking, are more or less in agreement on the process. There does seem to be something there that is useful, and there's general agreement on how to use it. Revelation, though, is people disagree on revelation. You have all kinds of religions out there. And there really isn't any one, even within Christianity, there are many different beliefs about revelation. So, you know, unlike science, where you generally have a procedure to follow, you don't really have that with revelation. How do you determine what revelation you should adopt.
Yeah, and that's why I tried to make that distinction between, you know, science and then I don't have the same thing for religion in general that I do for science. It's a very specific faith that I adhere to, and for reasons. I can give a slight rundown of some of the reasons why I would support this particular faith over others, if that's what you're interested in. And I discussed a little bit about the historicity of the Christian claims and how you can investigate that historically. And no other religion really makes such concrete historical claims on the basis of a variety of witnesses recorded over, you know, many, many centuries, all the prophecies and stuff regarding Christ. And so there's that aspect to it. Do you want me to get into more detail on the rest of the argument?
Well, I guess not so much on yours particularly, but almost everybody in a religion will come up with their reason. Yeah. And it's like they've all got their reason. But why are people to be so sure that one revelation is correct and the others are wrong?
Yeah, and that's a really hard question. I could only answer that in a particular of my own, which I think is probably more detailed than you want. I can't give a general answer to that. Yes?
Francis Collins expounds in his book, Language of God, how he can, he was a top scientist, who's head of the National Institute of Health, and also head of the Genome Project back in the 90s. He's also a Christian, and he expounds that in some depth in his book, Language of God, and another book, Language of Life. Both good books for, you know, on the same topic.
I haven't read the second book, but the first one was amazing. Yeah.
I have a general question. I'm a theist Christian myself, but I don't like the whole comparison between religion and science. To me, because religion seems to be an ethical theory of living a good life, and science seems to be a tool to understand your surroundings. So you can't really compare. It's like apple or dog, where in those exercises of trying to do a comparison seems to be pointless to me. So what do you think of that?
So what I would answer is, I think you're absolutely right that you can't compare them in terms of their goals. They have different goals, right? And that's why when we make a mistake is when we try to forget that they have different goals, right? When they start making claims, ontological claims about reality that start to overlap, then they do have a comparison because reality is one. And I don't think there's an issue there. But I don't like the idea of completely divorcing them because then you have two realities, right? So they're describing reality with different methods, with different goals. And so they rarely overlap. But when they do, I think they're going to make the same statements, if that makes sense.
Because I want to follow up. The only thing is because the one language you use to talk to both will be math, and math doesn't correlate with religion.
So one example of where I think they started to come together. And I didn't prepare notes on this, so I'm really going off my memory and it's semi-vague here, but when you look at some psychological aspects, right, and you have the church teaches things about how we can relate and how we can understand the world and the way reason operates and things like that, and has throughout the centuries, because we need to know that for how we interact with one another in the world. So it has that moral connection, right? Well, contemporary neuroscience is learning a lot more about that too as well, and contemporary psychology. And it's amazing to when you read some of these things and you see, well, yeah, I mean, that matches up very well with what they've been saying there. But that's no surprise because they're describing the same reality. But they're coming at it from different perspectives. One's trying to describe the human person scientifically, one's trying to direct the way we should live our lives, and they have that intersection point there in the way our minds work psychologically. And so points of overlap do happen.
We have a
time for one more question because I want to get us out of here by.
Thank you. My name is Hon Ojan. I'm a mathematician at the same time and a philosopher. As a mathematician, I did a research for about 28 years. Now, I propounded a phase, a branch of maths out of applied maths as equation science. Then I decided philosophy. I took my time to look at science and religion, the eternal controversy. And I found out that there's a relationship we can express as an equation between science and religion. My question to you now is that I supported all that you said. Now, do you believe that there's a symbolic relationship between science and religion? Symbolic relationship between science and religion. You know, most of the time we all have abstract relationship, but something very symbolic that you can touch, that you can just see it like just like an equation that bridge the controversy between science and religion. Do you believe that?
I think I would have had to have studied the mathematics you've studied to really even be able to answer that. So I don't know.
That's it. Okay. Well, thank you very much.